And oh, I just forgot that we hadn't recorded yet. People who are learning, so this is great. Surprisingly, there was no one from industry, and I'm wondering, Mick, did you not fill out the form? Actually, this is not true because the last registrant we got is from industry. So now I think we have two industry people. Where are you from? We're from all over the world. There's a nice concentration of folks in Europe. So here's a little zoom in on that. But generally, we're from all over, a few people in America, South America, Asia, and Australia. Sadly, no one from Africa or Antarctica. We also asked you what tools you use to analyze your data. And just like last year, most people are using MATLAB, Python, or R. We've got a nice number of people in MATLAB, followed by Python and then R. This one poor soul speaks assembly. I mean, I don't even really know assembly, but he's by himself or she's by himself, so for them. We also asked if people spoke Lisp. I mean, I don't know, but no one does. We also asked a little bit about your interest and your research directions, and so I compiled all of those words into a word cloud, and the usual suspects show up: auditory, attention, speech, and EEG. It's pretty much the same every year, and this is not really a surprise, but some of the fringe words here are a bit more interesting to me because they illustrate that we're taking the TRF a bit further beyond the domains of speech and music to things that are, like memory and emotion, and then actually using them to do to understand brain responses to movement, which I think is really interesting. Maybe sometime in the future, we'll have someone that can talk to us about how we can TRF movements. I also learned that my analysis for this was not very good. It broke up some words that should not have been broken up. Sorry about that. So finally, five people that are on the call that you're here to see. We've got two great keynotes from Lucas Parra and Micah Halbron. We'll have an update today from our 2022 CNSP Project Award, Giorgio. And then tomorrow we'll have two tutorials from two great people, Marley and Ola. So here's how today will go. Lucas will give his keynote speak in just a moment, followed by Joe and Giorgio. And then we'll break today around 5:40 Dublin time. And then we'll come back a few minutes later for the second session today, the tutorial. In between there, there'll be some time to have a moment, get a drink of water, have a break, or you can stay on the call and ask some questions if you're having problems getting your CNSP resources set up. Tomorrow will be much of the same sort of schedule. We'll start again at the same time, 11 a.m., sorry, 4 p.m. Dublin time. We'll do a 2-hour session as normal, break around the same time, and then come back for the second tutorial session around the same time. For that session 4, you'll choose which session to go to. You'll either be going to track 1 or track 2 to see Marley or Ola. So today, we have Lucas Parra. He is the Harold Shames Professor of Biomedical Engineering at the City College of New York. He's got an impressive resume with hundreds of papers and tens of thousands of citations. But here's what I actually appreciate about Lucas's work. Here's his most cited paper: convolutive blind separation of non-stationary sources. I don't actually really know what that means, but I know that it's complicated, and I know that it's probably a really good analysis technique. His scholar profile is littered with titles like this involving complex things like joint decorrelation, intersubject correlation, correlated components analysis, canonical components analysis. Sometimes people end up missing the forest for the trees. Well, Lucas is in the weeds here. Yet he doesn't miss the forest, and this is evident from some of his later talk or from some of his later papers. Conscious processing of narrative stimuli synchronizes heart rate between individuals. And also from the title of his talk today, Narratives Synchronize the Body and Mind. So I will stop sharing here and turn it over to Lucas, who will tell us about narrative synchronized body and mind.
Very good. Thank you for the introduction. Thanks for organizing this event. It's a lovely group of people from all over the world, 68 participants. I was wondering how the hell do you invite all of these people to come to an online event? Welcome, everybody. Okay, so I want to do something a little different. Hopefully, it's an experiment. I like to interact with you guys. So I'm going to stop a lot and give you opportunity to ask questions. I want you to interrupt me. I'll show a little bit of code. So hopefully this is not going to be the usual endless sequence of slides that put everybody to sleep and sent them running for their email and messages. So I'll try to keep you engaged, which in fact is the topic of the presentation. I love to see people's faces. So if you're not shy about turning on your video, that'd be great. That's the way I find out that you're with me. So don't be shy, turn on the video. I'll be looking at you. There you go. I got some takers. Very nice. So let's get started while you all turn the faces and look at each other and say hello. When you have questions, raise your hand. Somebody will be monitoring. And when you raised your hand, it means that you want to ask a question, and then you can unmute yourself and I'll hear your question. Otherwise, I won't know that you have a question. If you're feeling very shy, you can also type your question into the chat. And then I think Aaron will read it. That's how we're going to do it. So don't be shy about asking questions. So let me share the screen. I have to set up my screen a little bit. This can stay here. Let's see, this is going to move over there. And this is going to be wrong place. All right. So, no, that's the wrong presentation. I'm sorry about that. Pieces were not starting well. If I'm sharing the screen, yeah, I'm sharing the screen, right? Okay. You guys see the title that says Narrative Synchronizes Body and Mind, I hope. If not, somebody will tell me. So I'm at the City College of New York, beautiful campus here. The work that I'll be talking about today is from a few students, Jens Madsen, Samantha Cohen, and Jason Key, that have put this together a couple of years. There's a few more people I'll mention along the way. So I was very inspired. I don't know if you know the work from Yuri Hassan and David Heger back in 2004. I heard a talk of theirs. It was fascinating. They had people watch movies and they were recording brain activity. This was actually with fMRI. And the basic observation is that people's brains synchronize. So they, in this case, fMRI signal as a sort of function of time ended up correlating between two individuals. I was fascinated by that work. And since I do EEG, we tried to reproduce something like that with electroencephalography. So we measure something that's called inter-subject correlation. So we have multiple people, say, watch a movie or listening to a story, and then we record in all of them their brain activity, and then we compare the brains of two subjects and correlate it with one another. And that way we measure how correlated that that is. So this is work from Jacek Dymochowski back in 2012. And the first observation is that this metric of inter-subject correlation is very strongly modulated by attention. So this was activity recorded while watching a Hitchcock clip. I don't have time to actually show you too many movies today. And the basic observation was, so each dot here, this cross, is a person watching this Hitchcock clip, about 5 minutes worth of movie. And we measure how similar is that person's brain activity to that of the group, the other participants, while they are regularly attending or when they're distracted. Our usual manipulation for distraction is count in your head in steps of seven backwards. So that's a very difficult task. Meanwhile, you're still looking at the video, you're still listening to the sound, but evidently your brain is not with it anymore because the brain activity is then no longer correlated to the subject. So we get this precipitous drop in intersubject correlation. So this person here was very correlated to the group, and when distracted was very, I guess, uncorrelated from the group. And the effect is so strong that we can draw a line and perfectly discriminate the person attending or not attending. So I don't know about you guys, but I've worked on electroencephalography for many, many years, and I have never seen an effect this strong on any metric. So this is much stronger than alpha activity, much stronger than anything I've ever seen before in terms of measuring attention. In fact, this metric of intersubject correlation, Samantha Cohen did an experiment where she asked people about the content of the movie they just saw 3 weeks later. So 3 weeks later, people got online a quiz basically about the content of the movie they saw. And we looked at the brain activity during the video and what they recalled afterwards. So the percent correct answer. Zero is the mean of the group, by the way. So people that were more correlated to the group than the average also remembered the story from 3 weeks ago better. So essentially, during encoding, we can measure how well people will, 3 weeks later, recall the content of a story. And it's a pretty robust effect. We have replicated it a couple of times. So how do we do this? How do we measure, actually, intersubject correlation? So we measure this with components. So if you guys work with electroencephalography or MEG, perhaps the concept of a component is not new to you. So for instance, independent components, something that people are very familiar with. So we take the activity, say, from subject one, which is, you know, samples and time. This is only a cartoon brain EEG activity. It doesn't look like this, but you have multiple sensors and multiple samples. And then we combine the sensors with a weighting matrix. So say sensor one gets one value, sensor two gets another one, and so on, so that we get a single combined time course from subject one. And we do the same weighting for subject two. So we get another time course from subject two. And the objective is for these weights to be such that the red curve and the blue curve are as similar as possible. By similar, we mean correlated. So we will find weights, components, W, that will make the activity between two subjects as similar as possible. I hope this makes sense. I'm going to pause to give people opportunity to ask questions. So if there's already a question, let me now raise your hand. Really? 68 people, nobody has any questions so far.
We're 72 now. And if you're shy, please type in the chat.
All right, while you think about whether you have questions or not, let me switch to some code.
We have a raised hand.
Oh, say again?
We have a raised hand, Camila.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
So when you say that you adjust the weights to get subject one and subject two to be as similar as possible, do you do that pairwise for the whole group, or how do you find weights that adjust the similarity for a larger group than two people?
Wonderful question. So you can do it. There's two ways of doing it. Everybody gets their own weight. So I have to adjust my brain activity to be as similar as possible. So others also, each one with their own weights, or you can share the weight. So the same weight for everybody. It turns out, and this is perhaps no surprise, that if you use the same weight for everybody, you get much smoother responses, much less noisy results, but somewhat weaker correlation. If everybody gets their own weights, then you need a lot more data to get similarly smooth results. But yes, you can do both. It's different algorithms at the end. One is called canonical correlation. The other is correlated components, which is the one that I'll talk about. But a wonderful question. So it turns out doing this business with a single weight gives a little equation like this, which if you have learned eigenvalues in linear algebra at some point, you might have seen an equation like that. This is an eigenvalue equation, it's called. And principal component does the same thing. There's versions of this for independent components. So this sort of equation with eigenvalues shows up a lot. In this case, we're trying to maximize the between subject covariance divided by the within subject covariance. So if you do that and you look at the weights, you get components sort of like this. So this is the component in the EEG that during video watching captured most of the correlated activity between subjects. So this is the case where we're sharing the weights. There's a second component that looks like this and a third component that looks like that. And frankly, a fourth one that I'm not showing that's just like the third, but symmetric. So it turned out to the other way around. And let me show you some code in case you feel compelled to do this at home. So if you downloaded this, you might have gone to this website. You can do this right now. So if you go to paralab.org and click on the on resources, so you can, I'll give you some time, where it says intersubject correlation here on the resources, you click code and test data and you come to this page. And you can download this zip file. So I'll give you a second to do that. You can download that. So if you're a MATLAB user and if you have MATLAB on your computer, I already downloaded this. So if you don't have time to do that right now, that's quite all right. I'm going to change to, it's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to change to, let me try this.
While you're doing that, I'm going to ask a question that was on the chat.
Yeah.
It was, why don't you just calculate the coherence between corresponding channels? So I guess maybe like what's the difference between intersubject correlation and coherence?
That's a very good question. While I fiddle with this, I will try to answer it. So why don't I just measure the coherence between individual channels? The reason for that is I can correlate one channel with the corresponding channel of the other person. Or I could correlate the channel of one person with a different channel of another person. So right there, it gets combinatorial, right? All the possible correlations you could measure, coherence you could measure. I'm having a hard time, so I'm gonna exit out of this and switch into MATLAB. Do you guys still see my screen? Is MATLAB on the screen?
Yes.
Yep.
Wonderful. So I hope I answered that question. So if I don't do the composition of components, I have to basically commit which electrode with which electrode to compare. And just comparing the corresponding electrodes might not really capture everything that's in it. Instead, we're going to try to capture components that is sort of virtual sensors. Think of it as a combination of electrodes that are virtual sensor. So here I'll give you some examples. So I loaded already this data file. If we look what's in memory for this data file, it's got one big variable called X, which is number of samples. In this case, typical for EEG is 50,000 samples. Let's see what's the sampling rate here is 256. So this is maybe a few minutes of video, maybe 5 minutes or so. I have 70 channels. So this is 64 channels plus some EOG electrodes, electrodes on the eyes. And then I have 18 subjects. So they are nicely time aligned. I arranged them so that this first sample in subject one is the same moment in the video as in subject two, three, and four. So they're nicely time aligned across subject. And all this thing takes is basically a volume. If you know that some channels in these subjects are bad, you can tell it a list of channels that are not that good. And you can tell it the list of channels that are for the eye movements. And that's it. So I ran this code already. You can just type in, if you're doing this at home, you can just type ISCEG and it will use this data from Samantha Cohen from 2016. And will generate this figure that you see over here. So what are we seeing? So up above you see the components, and this is what in IMAGE and EEG sometimes called the forward model. So how does that activity that's shared by subject look on the surface? So this is the first one you see as occipital activity. It's not surprising. Why? Because these are participants watching movies. So it's obvious that you might find some occipital cortex involvement in here. You get this symmetric distribution, which we think is mostly auditory, and then other stuff, okay? What you see down in this panel is the level of correlation of each subject and each component. So the first component, by definition, just like in PCA, captures most of the variance. This component and this algorithm, which is called correlated component, captures most of the covariance between subjects. So it's component one and two, and each dot is a person. So how similar was that person to the group, essentially? And over here, we have the same thing resolved in time for each one of these three components. So there are moments in time, like over here, where the correlation was pretty high, that we interpret to mean that people were pretty similarly responding. And I will tell you later that, or our interpretation is that people were very attentive. So the code, if you just want to know what it spits out, it spits exactly these things that I've mentioned. It measures the overall level of intersubject correlation. It gives you a number per subject. It gives you a number per second. And then it gives you what we call a backward and a forward model. So this W is what gives you the component, and A is the corresponding forward model that's displayed here so that you have an idea of what this activity is. So this was a lot of information. I will pause again to see if people have questions. No questions?
I've got one.
They've
actually
got one. This
it might be a little out of the anyway. Is there any way to yoke this to the stimulus? Like the way that one of the things that I like about it is that it's not yoked to the stimulus, and that right. You don't have to like input like an explicit thing. And you like if you want to see something that's like common between two different like experiments, maybe that should be one thing, you can do that and without any like explicit stimulus thing, but sometimes
so
it would be nice.
It's implicitly yoked to the stimulus, as in it's aligned to the stimulus. So without aligning this to the stimulus, this correlated activity would have nothing to do with the stimulus.
Right.
Both subjects or all subjects being aligned to the stimulus, we're only extracting activity that's evoked by the stimulus. So this is stimulus evoked activity. And only stimulus evoked activity, because otherwise there wouldn't have anything in common. So in that sense, it's yoked. It's not yoked in the sense that we're extracting components that have something to do with specific features of the stimulus. This could be anything about the stimulus. In fact, it could be any nonlinear property of the stimulus. This doesn't have to, unlike the temporal response function approach, that's a linear relationship between a stimulus feature and the brain activities, could be any nonlinear property of the stimulus that we're capturing, which is kind of a nice thing. It is disappointing in the sense that we don't know what these components are. And this is most of the critique that I've received for this kind of work is, well, what is this component? Well, like, what does it mean? Does it have to do with what? And so that's this thing that's perhaps a little unsettling about it. So therefore, I'll show you a different way of doing it. So the other way of doing it, which we conjecture is, so we argue that the stimulus, and I'll show you a video game just soon enough, the stimulus drives the brain in both individuals, say, and therefore it's correlated. What about measuring just simply how correlated the brain activity is with the stimulus itself? And so this approach we call stimulus response correlation or tracking. This is what people in speech would call speech tracking if the stimulus was speech. So we have our own particular way of doing this. And I'll show you this. We have done with video for the first time. So I'll show you a video. So this is participants are playing this video game. This is like Mario Karts. And you see all these arrows, these red arrows, they're not really seeing these red arrows. This is something we extract from the stimulus. So people that do speech processing, they extract maybe the sound envelope. We for video extract the optic flow. These arrows are the optic flow, like how are things locally moving on the screen. You also see eye tracking, by the way. Those two circles in the middle is eye tracking. So we will then correlate the brain activity to how strong these red arrows are. So kind of like the volume, if you will, of the visuals. How much movement is there? And what we find is that when people are playing this game, so this is the stimulus response correlation now. So this is yoked to the stimulus, if you will, specifically optic flow. So if you look at people actively playing this game, you get pretty high correlation. So these are not small numbers, by the way, with the EEG activity and this optic flow. Now, this is the total optic flow anywhere on the screen. And then this is when they're passively viewing. Now, we also did another thing, which is we told them that they're controlling the video game with their brain activity. Of course, that was not true. They were just told that that's what they're doing. So this is brain-computer interface. They thought, oh my, this works really well. It actually, we're playing back a previous game, and they had no idea that they're not actually controlling this screen. So we call this sham play. And sure enough, people that thought they're controlling the brain, the video game, had brain activity that was just as correlated, if not more, to the optic flow in the screen as the people that were actively playing. My point being that this metric of correlation really captures how engaged the audience is with the game, even though they're not really controlling the input. So just like with the temporal response approach that you guys are familiar, we extract components. So rather than doing this one electrode at a time, we do it again with components. So this is the first, second, and third component. And these are the corresponding filters. So how does this whole thing work, actually? And here's a cartoon. And this cartoon is already too complicated. So I'm actually going to stop screen share and give people the opportunity to ask. And instead, I'm going to show you something on the board to explain what we just did. You guys see the board?
Yep. Still there?
Any questions so far, by the way? No? All right. So the approach that maybe some of you are familiar with is that there's some stimulus feature that's coming in. Let's call it X of T. So this could be, if you've been working with sound, this might be the spectrogram over time, or it might be the speech volume over time, or something like that. And that goes into a convolution. We call this a linear system, right? This is the so-called temporal response function. More conventionally, by the way, this is called the impulse response. So I resent Ed Lalo for calling it what it should be. But at any rate, temporal response function signed by me. It's the impulse response. And then the output is some other thing, namely the brain activity. Okay. And so this is essentially the model of the temporal response function. And people call this model, so Y of T is H convolved with X of T. They call this encoding. This is an encoding model. How does the brain signal encode the feature of the stimulus? So that's that some of you are familiar with. Another approach is very popular in also in EEG, but also in fMRI, is to decode the brain activity. So a lot of what the news articles pick up about brain reading works kind of like what I'm just about to draw, which is you have many brain signals, maybe like so. And so you have, at every moment in time, you have a whole vector. Let's call this Y vector, Y of T, okay? And that vector Y of T gets multiplied with a matrix, and out comes the stimulus feature, X of T. So the equation here is something like X is W times Y. Okay, and of course, these things can also depend on time. This could also be multiple features, and this can also depend on time. And so this is typically called decoding, brain decoding. So this is a brain reading, right? So all of the news articles you see about, oh my God, we can decode speech or music or whatever else from brain activity are some flavor of this decoding. So what we did is what you just saw that we did with that video game and other applications is sort of a hybrid thing. It's a bit of both. So we take the stimulus and pass it through an encoder with a convolution like so. So this is, again, x of t. That generates a signal c of t. And on the other end, we're going to decode. So we have the brain activity measured here. That's y of t. Makes another signal, C of T. And the goal is that they're as correlated as possible. So this measures correlation. And we call this stimulus response correlation. Okay? So that's the approach. And this is sort of a hybrid between encoding and decoding. All right, so that's the approach that we have taken with the results that you just saw on video games. We've done this also with speech and a whole bunch of other things. So let me go back to screen share. So I'll show you some more results. Any questions so far?
Yeah, there was one in the chat and then another that might want to ask you in person.
Yeah, Rick.
In the chat, can one move from sensor space to source space with the metric just presented to quantify interpersonal correlation?
Quite yeah, sure. So to go back to this picture. So this picture here, this would be the source. Right, and this will be the sensor. And yes, you can go back and forth between the two. So the going backwards is what's called the forward model. So this is a forward model and this is the backward model. So what the algorithm really extracts is the backward model, but you can always reconstruct a forward model from it. And in fact, what I was showing you before was the forward model. So going from source space to sensor space, but you can also go that way. In fact, that's what the algorithm really does. By the way, the algorithm to find these things is called canonical correlation analysis, was developed by Hotling in the 50s. So it's a really old algorithm. It's not something we invented. What we invented is this sort of idea of doing both decoding and encoding at the same time. All right. Other questions?
Yeah, I had a quick question about the type of stimuli that you can use.
Yeah.
So I'm more familiar with auditory evoked responses, thinking of like ba and da or something repeated over and over. Yeah. Can you do this kind of analysis on that using that type of stimuli, or does it need to be continuous stimuli?
No, anything works. Now, if you have events like the ones you have, the conventional approach is event-related potentials. It turns out that doing something like this, or even the temporal response function without, by the way, this thing here, what I drew here, if you get rid of this, you're basically back here. And this is what, if you get rid of this sort of complication of extracting components, but you do it electrode at a time, one electrode at a time, you get the conventional temporal response function. So does the temporal response function or this one work for events like the ones you have? And the answer is yes. And the impulse response you find here or here, the temporal response function, you would call an evoked response or an event-related potential. So absolutely, you can do it with either.
Okay. And then
other questions?
My other question I had is, you're just displaying three components. Is that just because of those are the three largest, or is it like ICA where, you know, if you have 128 channels, you get 128 components?
You get 128 components here too, but they're nicely sorted by relevance. The first one captures most of the correlation. The last one captures the least. And mostly you're in the noise at the end. So unlike ICA that doesn't have a preference for one component or another, this decomposition technique gives you a sorting for the one that explains most of the stimulus and then the second and the third and so on. And between each other, they are actually uncorrelated. So you can think of this as doing temporal response function and some sort of blind decomposition at the same time.
Are they
the silly ICA in front because you're doing it here?
Sorry, I had a question, but I just totally forgot it when you were saying that last part. I'll ask it again if I think of it.
Okay. We're good? I'm happy to chat and not show any more slides. Ed Lawler in the house. Very nice. Hi, Ed.
I have a question, Lucas.
Yeah.
Do you think, in terms of number of subjects, would there be an upper bound to what you can get? Like, is it the case that if you keep adding subjects, it will keep getting better?
Or which of the two techniques, the inter-subject correlation, you know?
I suppose, sorry, I'm talking about the CCA style, the inter-subject CCA correlation. Yeah.
So, you know, the more subjects you have, the more robust it becomes in a way. But also it gets blurrier. So you might argue that eventually too many is too many. Usually we get nice results with this starting at 15 and upwards. You can, by the way, Alain de Gévenier, he has done it with extracting components for each individual subject. He's done similar things. So you can mix and match whatever you want, either a single set of components for all subjects or each one gets their own. It's a usual sort of parameter, number of parameters issue.
Would you ever mix different types of recordings?
What do you mean by different types?
Even, you know, starting from simple to, you know, data recorded from here in my lab and recorded in your lab, still EEG, but, or even EEG, MEG.
If they are in the same sensor space, so if they have the same location of electrode, I think that's quite all right. If you are combining activity from different sensors altogether, I would have to think a bit about it, but I think you could potentially play games and combine. But I have to think about it. Certainly not off-the-shelf code. So let me show you some code for this. So this is stimulus response correlation. It's the same website under resources. You click here. It brings you to Jacek's GitHub. You download the code here, download. I did this already. So let me change to MATLAB to show you what that looks like.
Are you doing that? I remembered my question. Are all the components that come out, are they all nonlinear, or do you have like all the linear parts of the relationship in the first component, like CCA, I think it is?
So no, this is now back to the linear world. So here you're extracting linear relationship between the stimulus feature and the brain activity. So this is very much like the temporal response function. You're limited to linear response. There's nothing nonlinear here. So let me demo the code that I hope I answered it. This is the code that I have from Jacek. That's his demo. Let's see. Let's run this thing. Demo. That's not the demo. It gave me some sort of MATLAB demo. That's not the one I want to run. I have to change here now again. So these are the correlations in the first component. So these are the three components that they extracted and the corresponding impulse responses. This is on data of a single subject. So these are a little noisy. If we had run this on more, say 10 or 15, would have come out a lot smoother. But what you see here, the first one at least resembles the figures in the paper, which is this figure here, where we see that the activity, so this was, again, this was the sham play versus passive viewing, we see that the activity around 400 milliseconds was weaker in the passive viewing, and that was predominantly in the electrodes in the back of the head, as indicated by this first component. Can we do this with other stimuli? So we have done it with a lot with video. We have done it also with the usual things like speech envelope and even the semantic dissimilarity signal and a whole bunch of things. So you can use this pretty much where you would usually use it in speech. One example that I thought was kind of cool, we did this with the optic flow in different locations of the screen. So we looked at how much correlation, so stimulus response correlation, so how correlated is optic flow between a location and the screen and the brain. And so this gives us essentially a map in this video game where our subjects well, responding to, I would argue, attending to. And interestingly enough, during active play, they're paying attention to the horizon, the upcoming buildings, presumably because they're making an attempt not to crash into them. And we don't see that as clearly in the passive viewing. By the way, the eyes are always peeled to the center of the screen, so that's not related to eye movements. So let me just summarize what I've told you so far. It's a sort of a partial summary of this talk. Natural stimuli drive the brain, but only when the mind is engaged. So basically, when you're not attending, we had seen that with intersubject correlation, the intersubject correlation drops precipitously. Or in this video game, we saw that when the brain is no longer correlated to the stimulus, then we know that people aren't paying attention and aren't really engaged. And these are basically two metrics that we have used to measure this. So this sort of concludes that part. The main title of my talk, though, is not just about the brain, but about the body. So I'm going to switch topic on us, unless there are questions so far. So now we're going to start working with not just the brain signals, but we started looking at the heart, specifically the heart rate. We capture now respiration. We are going to measure gaze position, the pupil size in addition to the EEG. And we do this with audio only or with audiovisual stimuli. So videos or continuous speech, audiobooks, that kind of thing. So this is work that Jens Madsen has been doing over the last several years, I would say. And we had some really interesting results. So here I'm going to show you some basic signals. This was collected while people were watching educational videos. You'll get to see one of them in a minute. So this is EEG. The two colors are two participants. This is the heart rate. So you see how the heart rate is going up and down here. This is over several seconds. So this little bar here is 1 second. Gaze position, you see these two subjects are pretty much, I don't know if this vertical or horizontal gaze position, pretty much looking at the same place on the screen while watching movie. This is the pupil size. The pupil size in these two people is also very correlated. And this is respiration. So as we inhale, it goes up. And when we exhale, it goes down. You see that they seem to go up and down, but it actually they're not very correlated. So we published this in PNAS Nexus. I'll show you the gaze. And here I have an audience participation. So I need you to all pay attention. So you're going to see the same video. And on the left, you will see the red dots that you see here are the gaze position of people watching a video. And on the right, the same thing, but it's different people. And one of the group of people, either left or right, were paying attention. And on the other side, people that weren't paying attention. And the task for you will be to tell us or guess after you watch this, who is paying attention? Is it the people on the left, so these red dots on the left, or is it the people on the right? So I'm going to show you the video, and then we're going to take a poll, okay, an informal poll. Ready? So which one of the two groups are paying attention?
When you ask someone to draw a star, they'll probably draw something like this, or this, or this. Even ignoring rainbows, this is a very scientific, and we know stars are actually big hot round balls of plasma and far.
All right, so now comes my poll. Raise your hand if you think that the people on the left, these people, were paying more attention. So everybody that thinks it's the people on the left, please raise your hand. We'll take an informal count. Okay, we got about 32 people raised their hand. Okay, everybody raised a hand down. Hand down, hand down. Now we're going to see who thinks the people on the right were paying more attention.
No one.
Oh, wow. That's a biased sample. That's a totally biased sample. All right. Well, good. You guys were right. I mean, the majority has the right answer. It's the people on the left that were more attentive. Essentially, when people move their eyes together, are following the same thing on the screen, it's because they're paying attention. If they're not following what other people are looking at, then they're probably spaced out. And this is here, this is what we report here for all the signals for EEG, heart rate, gaze, position, and pupil. We're measuring intersubject correlation. But now we actually also resolved it by frequency. So this is essentially a coherence measure. So we wanted to know in which frequencies this happening. Before, I was just showing you overall how correlated are people. Here you see that the EEG correlation is actually dominant at pretty low frequencies. Most of you or most of us, when we analyze EEG, we look at activity of 1 second or faster. Most of the activity that seems to be synchronizing, yes, there's something above 1 hertz, even around 10 hertz, but most of it is pretty slow. Here's for heart rate. And by the way, how do we measure heart rate intersubject correlation? Simply as Pearson correlation, nothing fancy, except here we first bandpass filter the signals. So you see that there's a nice peak here around sort of 10 seconds, 0.1 hertz is 10 second time scale where the heart rate goes up and down. So basically when we're watching a movie, and this is also true when we're listening to a story, our hearts synchronize. So this is kind of a cute message here. When you're driving in your car next time and you're listening to a radio program that's playing live, then your heart rate, if you're really paying attention to the story, will be synchronized with that of all other listeners. So we do share something in common when we really go to the movies or we listen to a story at the same time. Our hearts are in sync. The same is for the gaze position. It's a very strong effect with video. And the same is true for pupil. So when we look at this metric of intersubject correlation, it turns out it's very predictive of whether people get content of these stories they saw correct. So these are educational videos. We asked afterwards quiz questions about the content of the video. And you see that pretty much all metrics except respiration are predictive of how many questions people got correct. So these are questions that were asked right after the video. So whether it's heart rate or EEG or gaze or pupil, they all predict the level of synchrony in how similar you are to a group will tell me if you're paying attention, therefore, if you remember what was said during the video. Again, if there are any questions, feel free to interrupt me.
It's okay. You've got people here answering questions for you now.
Okay. And in fact, these metrics seem to be correlated with one another. So subjects, each dot is here a person. People that have an eye intersubject correlation, the ISC in the EEG will also have a high intersubject correlation, the heart rate. That is, if your heart is beating similarly to somebody else, then so is your brain. And similarly for gaze and pupil. So this seems to all capture a common underlying phenomena. And so the theory we have behind it is that it's really the cognitive processing of the stimulus is what entrains body and mind. So essentially say the video that in this similar thing happens with audio only, subject one maybe is attending to the video in subject two, and that will synchronize eyes, heart, and maybe other signals. And the level of synchrony in one modality will be similar to the level of synchrony in the other, because body and mind are really all entrained to the stimulus, but only again if they pay attention. If they're not paying attention, none of this is true. And this is how these signals are correlated, I mean, co-modulated. Now, you see that I've drawn these arrows in two directions. Generally, we think that the brain controls the eye and maybe the brain controls the heart, but there's also this notion that the body controls the brain to some regard. So perhaps it's a two-way street. And so we're not the first to suggest that. The model that we have really is a sort of a simplified model. We know that when we're listening to a story, somehow that seems to drive also not just the brain, sort of the cortical brain that we pick up with EEG, but when we listen to a story, it appears to drive the autonomic system, which then drives the pupil, the gaze, and the heart rate. But perhaps the opposite is also true. Perhaps the heart rate or the gaze or the pupil also drive the autonomic system, and this is sort of has a bottom-up effect. Does that make sense? So here we ran a couple of experiments where we intentionally controlled luminance, gaze, and breathing. I won't be able to tell you all of this. We just don't have the time for it today. But I'll tell you a little bit of the results, and it's already complicated enough. So here are some results of people just listening to a story. So this is short stories, maybe 10 minutes or 5 to 10 minutes long. They're kind of fun and interesting to listen to. And what we first see is that the pupil synchronizes, but again, only if people are paying attention, and the synchronization is pretty stark. So attentive, again, at this very slow rate, the pupil of individual synchronizes, but not when they're distracted. This is a very strong effect. We had seen this with video, but with video, there's always the concern that maybe it's just the fluctuations of light that cause the pupil to dilate and contract. The same happens apparently when we're just listening to the story. By the way, people are watching, looking at a blank screen. We asked them to focus on a screen, and there's a fixation cross, but regardless of the fixation cross, whether it's there or not, the pupil entrains apparently to the story. So there are moments in the story where everybody's pupils dilated, and moments in the story when people's pupils are constricted, but only if they're really attending to the story. We correlated the pupil with the EEG. So this is conventional temporal response functions. So zero is zero delay. This side means that the EEG is ahead of the pupil, and this side means the pupil is ahead of the EEG. So it's not clear which way the causal relationship goes. It seems to be that a portion of the EEG seems to respond, the pupil seems to fluctuate before the EEG does, and vice versa. So we don't have a clear causal story. But the important thing I want you to notice is that if we look at where this activity is coming from, it seems to come from this sort of anterior central portion of the brain, which I've seen in many studies that look at the anterior cingulate. So we haven't done source reconstruction here, but we highly suspect that that's what might be going on. So that's the pupil while people listen to narratives. How about the heart? So the heart, we look at the heart rate, not the every beat, but the heart rate. And we do, again, this temporal response function business. So we take the pupil size and try to predict the heart rate from it. And we see that there is a significant response, just a little bit, on the temporal side that corresponds to the heart being ahead of the pupil. Similarly, if we try to predict the pupil from the heart, we get a more clear story here, which again is the side where the heart is ahead of the pupil. So it seems to be that the fluctuations of heart rate are ahead of the pupil's fluctuations. And we do the same thing with the EEG signal. So can the heart rate predict the EEG signal? And by and large, we see positive time lags here, which means that the heart is ahead of the EEG. Now, this is quite surprising. This is telling us that the heartbeat is slowing down or speeding up almost half a second to a second ahead of a corresponding, what we would call evoked potential or potential fluctuation. And once again, same culprit, same location on the scalp. And this, by the way, is true whether a person's attending, distracted, or resting. So inherently, it seems that the heart rate fluctuations precede fluctuations of the EEG of this sort of slow time scale. And this is, once again, activity that to us looks a lot like anterior cingulate. So the story that emerges here that perhaps the heart, and by the way, we drive it, we can also drive it with breathing that confirms this observation that I'm drawing here. So breathing is known to drive the heart rate up and down, seems to be driving the autonomic system, which then affects the pupil size and also the electroencephalography. So there seems to be evidence here for a cause, for a bottom-up effect of autonomic function of the heart onto a pupil and brain. So one last thing that I found cool that we found out is about gaze. So it turns out that when we are listening to a story attentive, our eyes are moving around more. So gaze, the power of gaze position is basically how much are our eyes bouncing around on the screen. So when we're attentive, we're actually moving our eyes more than when we're distracted. I don't know if you noticed it, but somebody that's not listening to you, they tend to sort of stare blankly at you. They're not really following anything. So the attentive listener will actually move their eyes. The disattentive, distracted listener would sort of stare blankly in the middle. And it turns out that this amount of fluctuations of eye movements also correlates between subjects. So the amount of how much you're bouncing your eyes around changes in a story. So moments of the story, well, I don't know which ones, but some moments of this story, people move their eyes more than other moments of this story. And if we look at that gaze variation signal too seems to correlate with this sort of anterior activity, though here it's possible that this has to do with the frontal eye field. So at any rate, this I thought is a kind of an interesting observation that I don't think is in the literature in any kind of way. We move our eyes depending on whether we're attending or not to what we're listening. So to summarize it all, narratives drive the brain and the body at a very slow time scale, but only when the mind is really engaged. Otherwise, the body does not seem to entrain at all. This sort of brain-body connection may be a two-way street, and we can measure these things either with intersubject correlation or with stimulus response correlation. We like to do one result in time because it gives us these sort of causal interpretations, and we like to resolve the other in frequency because it gives us an idea of what time scale this is operating at. And with this, I would like to thank the people. Jaco Sit is the guy in Paris, by the way, who works on patients with disorders of consciousness, who brought us to pay attention to this heart signal. And these are the students that have been involved in all this work. Code is here. You can just go to resources and download it on this page. And with that, I'm going to stop and give people opportunity to ask questions.
Well, thanks, Lucas. It's really cool to see that pupil EEG work come to fruition after the COG here meeting last year.
It's yeah.
Really cool. So, if you want to ask questions, now is a great time. Raise your hand and I'll unmute you. Or you can ask a question. Here's a question in the chat. If the distractor is a stimulus that is correlated with the stimulus, how would you think it may affect the results? Would that in turn increase the IFC? And is it a linear relationship with distractor strength?
So this business of how to distract people is really a subtle problem, right? The way we have done it, and this was a suggestion by Simon Kelly, by the way, who maybe some of you know, Simon Kelly's idea was do not distract people by putting stuff on the screen because then you're not really sure, are you analyzing activity associated with the distractor or are you analyzing activity that's this distraction related itself? So he suggested instead to do a very classic thing, which is a mental task. So you just tell people do something in your head. What's a good mental task? You can do any kind of thing. You can ask them to think about what you were doing, what you have for breakfast, or you can ask them, well, the task we use is to do math. So do complicated math in your head, count in steps of seven backwards, starting at say 1,000. So it's 1,000 is 993, 986, and 900 and 79. So you already see I'm staring blankly into space. And so that's the approach we take. And so this is all silent. So there's no stimulus to confound your task. But yes, this whole business of distractors and measuring attention with a probe stimulus is a whole complicated story that I don't really have any good answers.
Hey, Lucas, I had a question as well. Sorry I was late for your talk. I was teaching this morning. I'm still in my classroom here, actually. I just joined as soon as I could. The question I had was the cool new findings with the eye movements and stuff like that as well. Maybe you explained this and I didn't get it at the time, but I was interested to know the kind of speed of those, the size of those. Are these what we would consider just regular saccades? Are they micro saccades? Do you need to measure them using some super fancy eye tracker, or is it coarser than that?
It's coarse. So it's literally, you know, when I'm looking around, I can be looking around in a fairly narrow sort of area, or I can be looking around a fairly big area. And that's it. We're basically measuring the power resolved in time. Mm-hmm. Think of it as the saccade envelope,
mm-hmm.
or not saccade, but gaze envelope.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Cool. So okay.
Variations. So there's a paper that we cite that's also looked at this. Is gaze variation is a term that maybe is going to catch on. It's not saccades. It's not smooth pursuit. We don't really care. We're completely agnostic to it. We just like, over a period of time, how wide was your range that mm-hmm. you covered?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. it. And cool. So that range is what seems to be in moments of the story be bigger and other moments of the story be smaller. And why?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a wonderful area of research now to find out, because the thing that I find interesting about it is it's incidental movement. So it's movement is totally unrelated to the task. Just like you right now, are you touching your face, right? That's incidental movement, totally unrelated to you're listening to me. Hopefully you're listening. Looks like it. but so we do all of these incidental behaviors are seemingly totally a task unrelated, and yet they dominate brain activity. Perhaps you've followed that literature, but also we find that they are linked to what we're doing in our head, right? We're listening to the story, and apparently that's driving these. We think it has to do with arousal. Different moments of the story increase arousal, and that's when we move our eyes perhaps more. That's our current hypothesis. We have to still figure it out.
Cool. Thanks.
Here's one from the chat. Do you think it would be interesting or informative to measure inter-subject correlation without a shared stimulus? A lot of research is done to study interpersonal neural synchronization, where people are actually trying to exclude the synchronization due to shared sensory input.
So we record people sequentially, like, you know, now we're recording you and tomorrow we'll record another subject and so on, right? So there's no way they'll be synchronized any kind of way other than through the stimulus. Now there's a very big literature in what's called physiological synchrony, PS, in physiological signal, where the interest is sort of when people are sitting together side by side or looking at each other, interacting in some kind of way, that somehow they are then synchronized, their physiology is synchronized. Classic example, mother and child, or therapist and patient, or a performance and audience. So there's a whole sequence of a series of papers along those lines where it's never really quite well controlled. Why are they synchronized? Is it because they're sharing the moment and there's some common stimulus, or is this some sort of empathic, you know, correlation? But I would contend that if you put a screen between the two people and they don't see each other, then they don't hear each other, and they don't smell each other, there's nothing that can possibly synchronize unless you believe in some sort of, you know, esoteric kind of thing. And so I think that the only way that people will synchronize is because they are somehow sharing something that they're perceiving. And so I think that understanding what it is that synchronizes people in these interpersonal situations is kind of an interesting topic, and there's a big literature, but let's not pretend that this is some sort of, voodoo synchronization. It really is, I believe, the sensory percept of the other person that will synchronize people, even when they are sitting together.
Hi, Lucas. Nick Cross here. I have a question.
Hey.
Great talk. I found your work really interesting, looking at all the relationships between these different biometrics. And I'm wondering, looking at this correlation you showed between the heart and EEG or heart rate, do you think that there are any interesting or useful markers of cognitive function that could be determined from like a smartwatch heart rate measure? You know, given that we're seeing a lot of companies trying to develop brain computer interfaces now and all sorts of different neurotechnologies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the watch has a problem that's very noisy, but if you get a high-end armband, absolutely. I do think that you could do all kinds of in-the-wild experiments, and we want to do it, and we're thinking of how to do them. And we're doing a lot of online experiments with eye movements already. Yes, go for it. I think absolutely is a very rich signal. I mean, I don't know if you caught the scale of these correlations that I was displaying on the screen. They're much bigger than EEG signals. So the correlation of the pupil that we find or the heart rate, I mean, it's a noisy signal. I give you that. You need something for the heart in particular. You need much longer record because, you know, it's a very slow signal. So you need a lot longer records. But the level of correlation is definitely higher than the EEG, for instance.
Yeah, and so presumably
we're only scratching the surface. I think there's so many experiments you can think of looking at pupil, heart.
Yeah.
Now, I should say it's not the heartbeat. It's not like people's beat synchronizes. It's the heart rate. So your heart might be going boop, 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 boop. It's that speed up and slow down. That's what synchronizes. Not the actual beat to beat. It's not like our hearts are in absolute synchrony beat by beat. But that's not the case.
Thanks.
Okay, so for the sake of time, we'll move on. Thank you, Lucas. Everyone join me in thanking him with our see there click that button. Thanks, Lucas. That was a great talk. I really enjoyed it. We'll move on to Giovanni. So Giovanni will give us some updates about CNSB, what he's been doing over the last year or so, what we've been doing, and then he'll introduce his visiting student, Giorgio, who will give us an update on the project. So Giovanni, please take over.
I'm stealing the screen now.
Please.
Is this the right, can you see my slides?
Not yet.
Oh.
There we go.
What can you see?
Two pictures and your group.
Oh, great. So these are the slides. Lucas, thanks a million. That was great. Also the format. I like this interactive format for online presentations. I'll have to switch back to the old format. But it's very brief. So before moving on with the next invited speaker, who's Giorgio Piazza, I'll just give you this brief update on the work we have been doing. But also at the end, I'll give a brief mention on the travel grant sponsored by Embrain Train. Let me just put there a slide, one of the embarrassing slides with lots of faces that nobody looks at. But it's necessary to thank all the people that helped in the last 3 years in all the work we did with the workshop and also with the resources. So Lucas has shown this picture in different flavors on the board, on the slides. But the idea is, yes, we have in the different type of experiments that we deal with, that the CNSB initiative and workshop care about, we talk about, you know, some neural recordings and some sounds that are continuous or some videos or everything that Lucas has mentioned. And ultimately, we have an X and a Y in machine learning sense. So an X where we have, if you want, some stimulus features, and the Y where we have the neural signal. And we want to relate them somehow. So when we have, and again, in the way that Lucas described, when we have multiple features, imagine, and this is something that happened to me anyway, we had recorded a data set thinking about phonology, and then that same data set has been reanalyzed in, I don't know how many different ways. So many different papers from different labs can come out from the same data. And so this is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to reuse data from, you know, rather than having to record 1,000 times the same kind of experiment. And then the type of tasks that we're talking about, like listening to speech and music, is just more pleasant. So it gives you better access to particular cohorts that wouldn't be as willing to take long experiments where they have to look at, you know, flashing lights or individual syllables. So just more pleasant. Now, the challenges are that we want to tackle. One challenge is that, you know, the correct use and interpretation of the methodologies we are talking about, right? It's very important that if we start sharing resources, we start sharing code or toolboxes, that we also, you know, make sure that that there is no misuse of these tools. And so that's why we try to publish papers and also organize this workshop where we try to provide these resources for guiding towards the interpretation and how not to use these methods. And then the one thing that is very practical, even within the same lab, what happens is that we just end up using different versions of the same code for doing the same thing, which is problematic. It causes, it increases the risk for errors and also makes everything slower. So code reusability. So with here CNSP at the center of this slide, what I'm trying to say is what CNSP is about. So one element is trying to share some standardized analysis code for running different types of analysis. And of course, we started from the kind of analysis we were doing already. And by we, I mean Aaron and I and Nick and so on, all the organizers. To share standardized code, we need to agree on some standardized format for the data. And that's also another activity we have been working on. And then trying to take some existing data sets and putting them in the same format so that basically that same standardized code can be run instantly on all of these different data sets without wasting time. Then, of course, we have the workshops where we try to share new research and new tutorials, question and answers, and so on. And finally, we see this as an opportunity for, you know, creating a community, for networking, for connecting people that are more on the methodological side and instead other scientists that are more, you know, they have maybe less confidence on the methods and they want to connect with someone that has that expertise on doing more applied research. And for students, of course. And this is the kind of resources I use also in my own lab. So every student, PhD student or master student that joins, I just tell them, okay, open the CNSP website and download such and such data sets, download these scripts and try to learn from these. We have these new sections that we didn't have last year on lectures and tutorials from the various editions of the workshop. So you find the 2023 here as well. It is not just a repetition every year, right? So for example, last year we covered CCA, we won't cover it this year. So we don't need to repeat things that we have seen already, so that we leave space for new things. So check out those things. So what's new? So the first thing that is new this year is the CND format. So the continuous event neural data format. It's a data structure that we proposed for storing neural data that is specific to continuous sensory tasks like listening to speech. So it was, as I said, it was a necessity because if we want to share standardized code, we had to find a way to agree on some standardized data format. And the idea is that if you save your data in this way, then you can run these scripts that we're sharing directly. And then it also enables the design of graphical user interfaces and that sort of stuff. So CND, this data format, is somewhat after the raw data. So it's not your raw data. It's minimally pre-processed in a way that your stimulus features and your EEG are aligned and they are with the same sampling rate. And so you can run TRFs and CCA or inter-subject correlation more rapidly. And so you have access in this case to CNSP scripts, but also we connected this year, we connected this format with the work from Christian Broadbeck and Jonathan Simon and Nima's lab on these toolboxes that they designed. So you can load CND data files from their toolboxes now, and you can easily transition between Bits and CND. They are connected, and we included all the functions for doing so. But in reality, this is not something complicated. It's just basically a guidance in terms of what is the folder structure you should use, where should you put the code, where should you put the tutorials, the code, for example. Where should you put the data sets? How should you call the file names? If you follow these instructions, then basically it's just much easier to run the code we share. And we share this on our GitHub. So if you just go on our GitHub, and the links are all on the website, I'll show them in a second. You have this folder structure with the example scripts. We have more tutorials to add here. The libraries are not ours. Some of these are ours, but others they're just dependencies that we use. And then the datasets are empty. You just need to go to the website, download the dataset, and put it into this folder structure, and then you can run the scripts. We are setting up a new documentation page. It's a work in progress, but you can already find some instructions on, again, how to save your data in this format and so on. So on the website, you have this, on the resource page, you have all of these links, the GitHub, the documentation, and these other things I'll show you in a second. The data browser. So one thing that we built in the last year is a graphical user interface. So just an interface like this, which is built in MATLAB in this case. Wait for the next slide because that's much cooler. So the idea, apart from the ugly looking interface, which is MATLAB style, this gives you an idea of the parameters that you need to decide when you fit these models. And it gives you an easy access to do so. So basically what you can do is, and I'll let's see if I can take it up here. Yeah, let's put it on top. So this is just the GUI in my computer. And you can open here and you have access to whatever data sets you have on your computer. And they're all in the same format. So you can switch and it loads. And then it's going to give you the stimulus feature for that particular data set. And you can say, oh, I want to fit a model on this number of participants, on this amount of data per participant, forward, backward models. And just for sake of time, I don't have time to run it now, but basically you can run the usual TRFs, get prediction correlations, get TRF weights, but you can also compare different data sets. You can take your speech data set, your music data set, you can plot them on top of each other. It is still work to do, but it's a starting point to make things a bit faster, a bit easier when we want to look at data that we have already, available without having to talk with the person that actually shared that data every time. Now this is a proof of concept. It's a work in progress. It is a web-based data browser. So while the other one is a standalone application built in MATLAB, you don't need to have MATLAB. You just install it. But you still need to install it. This thing instead is in your browser. So you just go on your browser, you type this link, which I'll share on the chat in a second, and you can fit forward TRFs, backward TRFs, and so on. So encoding, decoding models. Why do I think this is useful? And again, lots of this stuff is done selfishly because we use it. So it happened to me, for example, to talk with scientists that wanted to run a new experiment, and they were asking me, can I run this speech listening experiment or this music listening experiment with 5 minutes of data because my particular population can't deal with experiments that are longer than 5 minutes? And usually my answer is, I don't know. I need to open my MATLAB and reanalyze some of my code. So with interface, basically you can go to some, load some existing data and select how much data you want to use and see basically for yourself if that is a suitable amount of data for your experiment and much more. So again, for sake of time, I'll cut it short. We describe lots of these new components in a paper that we just submitted to Archive. So the CNND data structure, the analysis pipeline, resources. We also include the simulation toolkit, where you can simulate EEG data in different ways. And I encourage using that because simulating data can be really, really useful, especially when your hypotheses are not that clear. It's not clear what you would get from a TRF analysis. So maybe before actually running an experiment, it can be quick and useful to use these functions. Okay. So just to conclude, the call for project proposals. So M-Brain Train, which is one of the most interesting producers of portable EEG systems. They have been supporting us with the scholarship last year and also this year. It's 1,500 euro. So what we encourage you to do is to propose a project and to write this proposal in 500 words. You can decide to say, okay, I want to visit Giovanni's lab in Dublin, or I want to visit Aaron's lab in Rochester or Segovia or Nottingham Trent or École Normale Supérieure. You can visit any of these institutions in the list that are related to the organizers, or you can propose some other visit to someone else, as long as it makes sense with CNSP. So as long as it has something to do with, you know, the resources that we share or something related to that, or anyway, something that is has an open science mindset. So whatever data you deal with, we would encourage you to share it. The call for proposal is on the website. You can find it here on the workshops page. Okay, that's all from me. Yeah, right on time. I'm a bit late, sorry. So I'm happy to introduce now the recipient of the travel grant from last year, Giorgio Piazza, who's a PhD student in the Infant Language and Cognition Group in BCBL, the Basque Center on Cognition, Brain and Language. Giorgio, he was awarded the project, the travel grant last year with a project titled Does Non-Native Directive Speech Enhance Non-Native Listeners' Cortical Tracking? Giorgio will be not talking just about that. Giorgio will be talking about his PhD project and also a little bit about what he did here. One cool thing that he did was to complement the scholarship that he won through the workshop with some other funding. So he managed to spend 3 full months in Dublin. And so he managed to collect data and also to, you know, he's close to publication with that. And so that's the kind of idea that that we like to promote. But even if you wanted to come for a week, that's still okay. Giorgio, are you online? Is Giorgio online?
Okay, yeah, I'm here. I couldn't unmute myself. Yes, sorry.
That's fine. Welcome to the workshop again, Giorgio. And yeah, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Okay, I think, I'm trying to share the screen. Okay, try now. Right, here we are. All right. So, well, thank you, first of all, Giovanni, and everybody for being here. I guess you can hear me well. If not, please let me know now. I'm going to talk about, mostly actually the project that I carry out during my research day at Giovanni's lab. The title I gave is slightly different, so non-native direct speech supports L2 learners cortical tracking speech, but it's basically the same thing. So it's also part of the bigger project of my PhD dissertation. It's all about non-native direct speech, which is a speech register. And sorry, let's see. Okay, it works. It also has other names, for instance, foreign direct speech. Usually, non-native direct speech is the preferred name because it's more neutral term. But for this presentation, I'm gonna use the acronym of from the old name, let's say, so FDS, just because it's easier, because it will be compared to native direct speech, which is, well, the acronym is NDS, of course. So just to make clear, it's not foreigner accent speech, would be the guy here on the right speaking in English, for instance. It's about the way native speakers, like the English girl on the left, but it could be any language, of course. That's the way how she speaks, she addresses an altular, so someone's learning English in that case, a second language. FDS, as compared to native direct speech, it increases speech clarity. And this is reflected in some acoustic features. For instance, low speech rate. So for instance, there will be a low number of syllables per minute or words per minute. And also an expanding vocalic space is known as vowel hyperarticulation. Just to give you like a graphical representation, it's not fundamental to understand this presentation. But this is how we calculate vowel articulation. It'll be taking the first two formants of the vowel production and plot them on a Cartesian plane. And then we calculate the area of the triangle. So the red triangle represents how the girl on the left will address the guy on the right. So hyperarticulating vowels, so producing the vowels far away from each other. And the blue triangle will represent the way the vowels of native direct speech, so how you speak to another native listener. This is interpreted as being promoter of language learning and also processing because it supports detection of vocalic functions because they're easier to detect, so they're not so overlapping. Apart from that, apart from assumptions, we also found in our latest study that's now under review that L2 learners, when they're exposed to FDS, they actually learn better and faster L2 novel words as compared to participants who were exposed to NDS only. So it seems to be a tool for teaching a second language, but we use single word presentation, a short sentences, sorry. So it is still unclear whether FDS promotes also perception of continuous speech. It would be like more naturalistic environment. And also behavioral studies are mostly, most studies on FDS are behavioral. That do not allow us to investigate the process of L2 processing while it's still going on, but when it's already completed. And of course, you know that EG allows that. Anyway, so far there's just a single study on foreign direct speech with EG. It was with a single word presentation. There's nothing on continuous speech and ecological value stimuli. And so one way, of course, to investigate whether FDS supports L2 processing is by using EEG and measuring cortical tracking of continuous speech. Well, there's no need to say this, but we'll say anyway. So cortical tracking is a synchronization of cortical oscillatory activity to fluctuation of exogenous stimuli. Of course, I read it. And of course, one feature you can study is speech handler, like the most typical feature. So there's also some evidence showing that cortical tracking of speech, especially in low frequency bands, usually delta theta more or less, is a marker of underlying process. And there's also some evidence showing that it's fundamental for adult speech processing. In some cases, cortical tracking has been linked to speech clarity, intelligibility, and so on and so forth. And also, it has been studied in infant language development, so in relation to infant direct speech, there is another speech register, in this case directed to infants, which shares a lot of features with foreign direct speech. So it is possible to explore, to investigate cortical tracking using temporal response function. Of course, you are here because you know what it is, but it's a regularized linear regression that maps it to the continuous stimulus to the neural response. And I think Giovanni is familiar with this figure here. You know that. And then it's possible to using the TRF to predict EEG response and correlate it to actual EEG activity. So this is a one possible outcome, one possible dependent variable that I'm using in this presentation. Okay. Another interesting feature of DRF that's possible to investigate various sets of features, not just like a speech handle, for instance, as other features that are non-acoustic too as well. For instance, like semantic surprisal, say. Of course, you already know what direction I'm going. So we aim to measure audio tracking in foreign direct speech and NDS, so native direct speech. But in the literature, it has been shown that cortical tracking is also affected by speech rate. And so we, for this reason, we added a third condition that we call slow NDS, which had the same features of NDS. So actually we use NDS and then we slow it down to measure the speech rate of FDS. And we did it by means of, there's the next slide. Dynamic time warping, sorry. So slow NDS doesn't have any feature that is expected to support L2 learners' perception. And also, it has never been addressed the impact of FDS on cortical tracking of second language speech. And of course, it's important to shed light on this point because it will tell us more about how a second language is processed also acquired. Because of the features of foreign direct speech that I told you about before, they are adapted to the L2 learner. FDS is assumed to promote, as I said, L2 processing, but not NDS. And this should be reflected on more efficient cortical tracking of FDS than NDS. And this should be true just for L2 learners, of course. So in the study, the present study, we aim to answer the question here. So the first question, does FDS promote L2 learners' cortical tracking speech? And if you have time, I'll just give you a hint about the next analysis we're running to answer the second question. So we ran two experiments. So data were collected in two different experiments. Why two experiments? Because we were two different labs, one in Spain and one in Ireland, and also with two different systems. One is by a seminar, one is brain vision. So in the first experiment, we collected data from 25 L2 learners of English, whose S1, L1 is Spanish. And then experiment two, so far 18 native English listeners. We are still in the process of collecting data. And all the participants listened to continuous speech in the form of storytelling in the three conditions. And each story was about 50 minutes each. And well, the stories were recorded with a British English accent, just to make it easier for English for Spanish participants. So while we're listening to the stories, of course, we record their participants' EG activity, and we also asked them to answer some questions about the content of the story. And in total, with the after each break, they answer 5 questions for about 25 questions per story. And also we ran a 4 TRF model, filtered low frequency bands, 1 to 8 hertz, and with the features of speech envelope so far. And here we are the results. For the comprehension results and for the comprehension score, as expected, we found main effect speech register, and participant responded with higher accuracy to the stories when the story was pronounced and foreign direct speech as compared to the other two conditions. Here, I highlighted in bold the main comparison of interest, which is foreign direct speech versus NDS, native direct speech. And this is in line with what we were expecting. And so they seem to be more accurate, so to understand better, say, the stories in FDS. Of course, we know there are other funds, so we cannot conclude much. So because there's tension, engagement, but this is still the first result. It's interesting. So for this reason, we also had more, of course, objective measurement. We use prediction correlations of the 4 TRF model, and we found that participants showed higher prediction correlation when they listened to stories in foreign direct speech as compared to native direct speech, as compared to slow NDS. And again, here the interesting comparison between FDS and NDS. So it seems that they were encoding better speech envelope where they were listening to FDS. Okay, so then the results of the English listener group, and as expected, we didn't find any difference across the three conditions for the comprehension score because they are native, so they don't need any acoustic feature to help them understand and process the stories. We also, well, I'd like also to stress out that there's no ceiling effect. We made sure that they didn't got all the same wrong answers. So there's some variability, which is important as well. And for the prediction correlations, we had something that was kind of unexpected, because we got a higher prediction correlation NDS as compared to FDS and slow NDS. So we're expecting that because of the slow speech rate or because of the acoustic feature, somehow we would observe higher prediction correlations in FDS and slow NDS. But instead, it seems that it's more important the fact that NDS was suited, so it was like meant to address native listeners, as it was the same for FDS. So just to then, now I will just sum up all the results so it'll be a bit clearer. So we asked ourselves whether FDS supports processing of continuous speech, especially for L2 learners. We found that it was the case, at least for the behavioral results, with the limitation I said before. And we found the same, congruent, consistent results for the TRF. In fact, we found that Spanish listener had higher prediction correlation in FDS, whereas English listener had higher prediction correlation in NDS. So it seems to be the case that it's not just FDS having some special acoustic features that make the make speech to be encoded better. It's the fact that there are the intended addresses of those speech registers, and also. It seems to suggest, the results seem to suggest that this is not an effect of speech rate, because while we find the same effect in both groups. So a slow speech rate would drive the effect, and this was not the case. And also we would find the same effect for slow NDS, since it was as low as FDS. And one might ask whether slow NDS was like weird or unnatural. We don't think so, also because we would expect an effect here. So we didn't find any difference between FDS and slow NDS in the English listener group. So probably it was just a matter of fact that they are not exposed, both groups, both experiments, the participants are not usually exposed to slow NDS, because they are either exposed to FDS if they are non-native, and to NDS if they are usually interacting with other native speakers. So these are the results for the presentation today, and just a quick hint on the ongoing analysis. So we are trying to answer the other question. More than about comprehension would be how FDS supports L2 learners semantic encoding, let's say. And so you use GPT-2 to extract semantic surprisal values. And of course, we align them to the onset of the words. And so we use it again, TRF model, so for a model to predict a response. But so I have no time to show results here, but I have some time for some questions if you have any. Thank you very much. Hope it wasn't too fast.
Great talk, Giorgio. Again, feel free to raise your hand. We'll unmute you or allow you to unmute if you have a question, or you can put a question in the chat if you have one for Giorgio. I did have a question. Actually, Ed has a question. This would probably be way better than mine.
Hi, Giorgio. Thanks for the nice talk. Thank you. Hope you can hear me okay. I'm in a different room now. I just had a quick question about how these results might fit with... I know Giovanni has published a paper before looking at using a lot of these EEG measures to determine someone's abilities in English, for example, as they go from a novice to an expert or a native speaker. Is there a relationship there with what you're finding in terms of this foreign? I know it's a different question, but I'm just wondering if there's still
I mean, we are thinking about using the coding again to decode the comprehension score they got. So in that case, I think it would be something more similar than from here. So I think you're referring to the Giovanni's paper 2021 two speakers. In that case, of course, there's no variation between speech registers, so it's just English as it is, and most probably I think they use like native direct speech, because like stories, So that's a lot in common, of course. And by that case, would be, well, we didn't have any variability between, well, we had some variability, but not that much between for the Spanish listener group. So they are all mid-low proficient in English. But I guess, well, I would expect to find similar results at least. But it would be interesting to see the coding if we find something different for like NDS and FDS in that case. So it's something that I will work on next future. Thank you.
Any other questions?
There is a raised hand, Aaron.
Oh, accidentally muted you, Marley. So you can unmute again.
Yes, I'm muted now, I guess. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Thanks for the talk. It was a really cool project. Maybe thanks. I missed it, but how is the acoustics of the speakers? Are they those two? Are they from the same speaker? Or not?
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't say it just for my time mostly. But yeah, it was the same speaker that recorded the same story twice. So the same British English speaker, female. And then we transform from NDS, we transform into slow NDS. But yeah, the comparison between FDS and NDS anyway is the same speaker, yes.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Okay, so if there's no other questions, we'll leave it at there. Thanks again, Giorgio. It's a great job. You did a lot of work in a short amount of time. Actually, not quite so short, but you did a good job in your project. So thanks for setting a good example for whoever follows next year. So we'll end it there for this session. That's the last thing we have right now. Oh, and I actually can't like do anything on my computer. I was going to show the schedule, but my computer's acting funny. So sorry about that. So we'll end it there. We'll meet back in about 13 minutes, maybe a little bit later. I'm going to have to run, maybe get a little bit of food and probably restart my computer because it's acting funny. But we'll start in the tutorial session for the tutorial people. And for the rest of you, we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for a great first session. Tomorrow we have Micah Halbron. He'll be giving us a talk about prediction and the brain using large language models. And then we'll have two talks from our tutorial speakers for you tomorrow. So we'll either see you in about 13 minutes or tomorrow. Ciao.
Thanks.
We'll leave this Zoom open for if anyone has any questions about setting up the tutorial. Fellas, I'm going to restart my computer. If you can stay on the call for at least until now or until...
Are we using the same call for tutorials?